Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to May's Exotics Club webinar. I'm delighted to welcome to Webinar Club our speaker for today, lecturer at the Royal Dick School of Veterinary Studies based at the University of Edinburgh, Emma Keeble. Thank you, Emma. I'm now going to hand over to you.
Thank you very much, Emma. It's a pleasure to be talking today at this webinar, and thank you for listening in. I have decided we're going to talk today about preventative rabbit medicine, and this is an area really of rabbit medicine that obviously is vitally important, but also perhaps sometimes overlooked, and often we leave owners to look after the rabbits themselves and perhaps not educate them in terms of how to look out for signs where there might be a problem. And there's a lot of things we can avoid happening to our pet rabbit cases if we plan ahead and have a proper preventative program in place. So thank you for listening in today, and I hope you enjoy the webinar. When I was starting to sort of think about rabbits and you know, why we have all these exotics webinars, I think, you know, what is special about rabbits? I guess more and more we are seeing these animals as very popular pets in the UK, and certainly owners are expecting us to be able to manage their case as well, and also as the animal is often part of the family, we have clients who see their rabbit as really quite an important member of the family and would like the appropriate care for that animal. I actually have a case at the moment which has cataracts and is being referred to an ophthalmologist, and the family have been able to take compassionate time from work to be able to do that. So this is a really important thing to understand as well, that these animals are very highly valued within the family. So, I mean, these are all sort of things that probably in practice we think about doing, but developing a proper preventative healthcare program for your rabbit cases is absolutely crucial for the welfare and well-being of your patients. And as I said before, I think sometimes we tend to overlook this a little bit and be a bit haphazard perhaps in our approach. But this is just the same as we should be doing with dogs and cats. We should be encompassing our rabbit cases into that same sort of preventative program. And this is something when you first see the case and when you first meet new clients, you should be talking about and going through with them. And trying to factor that into our normal consultation time is often key. What I do sometimes find though with rabbits is the first time that you see them as a case, there's a problem, and that is why the owner has brought them in. So perhaps trying to make links with local pet shops or breeders so that we can get these sorts of issues discussed with owners at time of purchase of their animal, so that they're actually thinking ahead and thinking preventatively before we get issues developing. And there's so much that we can help with as a veterinary surgeon in terms of preventing disease with these animals, particularly with exotic species. A lot of disease issues we see are related to diet and husbandry, and so educating our clients is absolutely key. So the plan today will be to go through that whole list and discuss what we're advising to clients, and have some chat about sort of common things that we see associated with poor husbandry and diet and what we can do to try and prevent those things. Just, I wanted to recap a little bit about myxomatosis and myxomavirus. This is actually quite a key problem still in pet rabbits, and we still see cases at our practice. It is really important, obviously, to educate clients that they need to vaccinate their animals. It is a nasty virus. It's a pox virus. It causes cutaneous disease, and then secondary infections can cause death. Clinical signs to look out for, and the initial stages, this can actually be quite easily confused with just a mild case of conjunctivitis. And I actually had a case in last year that initially presented with just slightly weepy eyes, slight swelling of the eyelids, and a week down the line, the animal had actually developed significant edema, and it was much more obvious that this was actually a case of myxomatosis we were dealing with. death can ensue, but it doesn't always ensue that rapidly. So these animals can often suffer quite significantly before finally succumbing to secondary infections. As you can see, these are all cases in pet rabbits that I've seen in my practice. I think the thing is that owners often don't think, if it's a house rabbit, that the animal can still develop this disease. And obviously, that's something we need to educate clients about. And it's still a bit of a myth that's out there. So this rabbit's showing obvious edema of the eyelids. I also had edema of the ears, of the muzzle area, and then the anogenital area as well. We can, and we used to see this a lot, occasionally see sort of milder forms of the disease where you just have small scabs, particularly over the bridge of the nose, and often lesions on the body as well. And these animals can survive with appropriate nursing and supportive care. And usually these animals have been previously vaccinated, and then the owner has forgotten to continue with that vaccination program, and the animal picks up the virus. I think we need to think about how we can prevent this in our pet rabbits. Now, obviously, vaccination is absolutely key, but also looking at how this is transmitted, we need to be thinking about appropriate flea control and also how to avoid mosquitoes and biting insects that can also spread the infection. And once it has actually been transmitted, then it replicates pretty quickly and spreads through the body and disseminates to other organs. Hopefully you're very much aware of the relatively new vaccine that is available. There is a vaccine that is actually combined with the RHD virus strain, and so it's a combined vaccine. Very clever technology this was used to develop this, and certainly I think most practices are probably choosing to use this because you're not needing to vaccinate separately. You can get the animal in one just for once, and you don't have to have repeat vaccinations. It's just once yearly on an annual basis, obviously. One thing that I think is important to realise that actually if you've got clinical cases, the immunity can take up to 3 weeks to develop. So in a face of an outbreak, we'd obviously want to vaccinate in contact animals, but we need to be saying to owners that this may already be too late. So this is where our preventative programme is absolutely key. We need to be regularly vaccinating to avoid animals getting this condition. And as we said, it's pretty nasty when an animal does go down with myxomatosis. Another thing just to note is if you've got breeders with rabbits, you're not supposed to vaccinate in the early days of pregnancy, and also breeding animals should be avoided as well. One thing to note is that if you've used different vaccines, now this may hopefully be less of an issue as people begin to use this newer vaccine, but certainly if a rabbit's been vaccinated with a different vaccine or has had a natural myxomatosis infection, then the immune response that's developed may not be as protective. And that's something just to be aware of and to let owners know. And this is particularly an immune response against RHD. Other things we can do with myxomatosis, and I think this is an area we don't often talk to clients in great detail about, but vector control is absolutely key. Recommending regular flea control, which we'll come on to talk about in a wee while, but also thinking about insect-proofing, screening animals. And this is probably just generally good practice because rabbits are going to be exposed to mosquitoes. And certainly up in Scotland, we have severe cases of midge infestations, and making sure that we've got insect proofing around the hutch if this is an outdoor rabbit is absolutely key. Thinking about rabbit hemorrhagic disease and how this is spread as well, we really don't know the true situation in the UK. This is not notifiable, and you know, rabbits tend to suddenly die, so owners will often not bring animals in to the veterinary practice. They may just die at home, and they think, oh, it's just a sudden either infection or toxin or whatever, unexplained death. So this is something that we don't truly know the incidence of, but when you do have outbreaks, it can cause significant mortality in groups of rabbits. So in terms of actually transmission, again, thinking about how we can prevent spread, there is an element of direct contact between animals, but we can also get spread from fomites, inanimate objects. For instance, if an owner was walking through an area where there were wild rabbits and then walked back and was in contact with their own animal, then that could be a potential source of infection. And for outdoor rabbits, then contact with birds and insects is also a potential problem. So absolutely important in this case to vaccinate outdoor rabbits, but I would also say indoor rabbits are at risk, as we said earlier. It can be very, very acute in onset, to the point where you really don't see any other clinical signs except death. And sometimes animals don't actually exsanguinate. They don't have the hemorrhage from the nares or the orifices. So, you know, owners can just think this is just a sudden onset occurrence and think nothing really of it, other than obviously they're upset their animal has died. But these cases may not be brought into the veterinary surgery. There are some very classic signs that you can see at postmortem, so it would be interesting to put this picture in just to show you the difference between an infected liver and a healthy rabbit liver. But really, there's no treatment for this condition, so vaccination, again, is absolutely key. As I mentioned earlier, there is this combined vaccine. We do have other vaccines that I think we tend to forget about, really because we've got the combined myxomatosis one. But there are other vaccines available as well. But it is something that I would absolutely recommend owners we vaccinate against. The thing, I suppose, with vaccination is it used to be 6 monthly and now it's yearly. So this has created a situation where rabbits are not being brought in as regularly as they would have in the past. And we would certainly recommend now that rabbits do come in every 6 months. A lot can change in a year. And really, particularly in older rabbits or rabbits with pre-existing conditions, 6 monthly health checks is much better in terms of picking up things earlier on and being able to prevent any disease processes from developing. So I wanted to talk also about neutering of rabbits. And this is something that would be discussed in your first consultation with an owner. Why would you recommend spaying rabbits? And obviously, most of us hopefully are doing this and recommending that we spay rabbits. I think it is something also to talk through with the owner in terms of the pros and cons, and to actually sort of educate them as to, you know, the type of operation that's involved, the anaesthetic that's involved, the aftercare that will be involved as well, and to discuss any potential problems that could occur with surgery, and also the reasons why we would recommend spaying. And certainly most of our rabbits now are neutered, and this is really reduced the incidence of uterine adenocarcinoma significantly. There are many other reasons as well why owners may want their animal neutered. Talking through these, and if there are particular behavioural issues, then that's also a key thing to discuss with the owner at the time. We usually do a preoperative assessment of the animal. Some people will do preoperative hematology and biochemistry just to have a baseline for that animal as well. And that depends on your sort of practice protocol. This is quite an old slide that I'm showing you here. This is actually an animal that had significant uterine adenocarcinoma and actually is a post-mortem picture. This is something we really hardly see actually now, because most animals are neutered and neutered at a relatively young age. So coming on to the age of neutering, older sexual maturity in larger breeds tends to be later on compared to the smaller breeds, which sexually mature at a younger age. So on average, we tend to recommend spaying from about 5 months onwards. I think the only situation where we might delay a little bit further would be in the very small breeds of rabbits. Certainly the Netherland dwarfs can be more difficult to intubate, and particularly if they're very small. And also if we're trying to get IV access in the smaller breeds as well, we might want to delay that a little bit longer. also, when you're coming to talk to owners about neutering animals, we do want to discuss, you know, a general health check, whether the animal is overweight or not, because if an animal is significantly overweight, then that will also make the operation technically more difficult. As you can see from this slide here, there's a lot of fat stored within the broad ligament, and in obese rabbits, this can be significant. Also, if you have a large amount of fat in the abdomen, then this can put more pressure on your sutures, and there is the potential, perhaps increased potential, for hernias to develop. So very key to make sure that you talk through these potential issues with clients beforehand. In terms of castrating male rabbits, then again, there are some significant reasons why we might want to do this. And certainly it seems to reduce any aggressive or hypersexual behavior that might be developing. It depends obviously on your pairings, but if there is fighting, then this can be beneficial. There are different methods of castration, and if you read through different textbooks, you'll find that, you know, there's debate as to whether you do this open or closed. Whichever technique you use, I think it's whatever you find the most easiest to do and you are happiest at doing. One thing to note with rabbits, though, you do have to always make sure that you close off the tunic, because there is a higher risk, because of an open inguinal canal, of eventration of gut contents and fat pads. So very important to close off your inguinal canal following castration. And most rabbits do tolerate this relatively well. One thing to note as well, and again to warn owners about, is that post-castration, there have still been cases of rabbits being able to sire and produce offspring. And I presume this is because there's still residual sperm within the remaining tubules, and this can occur up to sort of 4 weeks post-castration. So best to keep the males apart for that length of time post-surgery. What age do we recommend? Well, it's a similar age really to the female rabbits. Again, sort of perhaps a little bit earlier, we could perhaps start from about 4 months onwards. And hopefully, again, this is perhaps dependent on the size of the rabbit and also on your health checks. Hopefully, talking about husbandry of pet rabbits, hopefully we're all very much aware of what we would think of as good husbandry now for these animals. But it does astound me how many cases are still being kept in tiny conditions outdoors in small hutches. We also have the absolute opposite, where we have owners who have developed large areas within the house where the rabbit's able to roam and has variable sized enclosures and levels and entertainment systems almost. So there can be a great dichotomy really between the different types of husbandry that owners will be providing. So this is where at an early age we can come and discuss this with our clients and try and get a handle on what they are doing at home and how the rabbit's being kept. Because there's so many issues that can be avoided by good husbandry. Things that I've sort of had a think about, husbandry related, obviously obesity I think is such a common thing now in rabbits, and maybe this is because we are neutering a lot more of our rabbits, but I think also being house rabbits indoors, owners like to give treats and they like to sort of spoil their animals, and this can very quickly lead to a problem where the animal becomes obese. And we'll discuss the issues that are related with this in a subsequent slide. Other things that can happen, obviously fly strike in the summer months, if we're not looking after our hygiene of our animal, or if we've got an underlying problem that's resulting in matted sort of cecotrophs accumulating around the back end. Osteoporosis, if we've not got an animal that's exercising, that's been given a wide area to move around in, and also not potentially being exposed to vitamin D3, then this significant problem can develop. With house rabbits, toxin ingestion is quite a common thing. Now, rabbits seem to be relatively good at avoiding intoxications. However, this can still occur, and there are cases that have been reported. And certainly foreign body ingestion, if we've got animals that are chewing cables or wires or plastic, can be significant. I also wanted to talk a little bit about sore hocks, and I'll come on to this in subsequent slides, but this is something I would say that pretty much every rabbit that comes through my door, we tend to see a degree of sore hocks. And this is something that I find very interesting, but also we need to be thinking as vets, what can we do to avoid this? It's not a natural thing. So are obese rabbits, why are we worried so much about obesity in rabbits? Well, as I'm sure you're aware, in other animals, you know, we can get a whole range of conditions that are predisposed by the rabbit being overweight. I think in particular in rabbits, hepatic lipidosis is a major concern. If that animal, for any reason, goes off its food, it may not be related directly to it being obese, but if it's got a large amount of fat stored within its liver, it very quickly can go into liver failure and get secondary issues. More and more we are seeing cases of arthritis in rabbits, particularly as they're living longer, as their husbandry is improving, and certainly this can be exacerbated by the animal being overweight. It also can lead to problems with the bladder and also with defecation, because the animal perhaps isn't voiding as well as it should. It's overweight, it's not able to lift itself properly. You can get urine staining, urine scalding developing. And as I mentioned earlier, these sort of matted secretose, the rabbit might not be able to re-eat its own secretose, and therefore, as a secondary issue, it's getting accumulations around the back end, which can lead to fly strike. So we have a whole range of reasons why we need to be looking at keeping our pet rabbits at a good body weight. And there are some very useful body condition scoring information sites out, websites out there. So do get used to body condition scoring your animal as well as weighing it on a regular basis. And this is something we perhaps can use our practice nurses for and develop sort of weight clinics as we would for dogs and cats, and then discuss certainly appropriate diets with them. A lot of our pet rabbits are litter trained and are indoor house rabbits, and this can lead to potential for exposure to toxins around the house, and also chewing of electric cables, furniture. One in particular that I've seen as a problem are these type of lily plants, dumb cane it's called, and the whole sort of family, I think it's called Diefenbachia, are potentially toxic to rabbits and can lead to problems if ingested. So again, we need to talk to our clients about this and let them know that there can be problems, and to avoid any contact with something the rabbit might eat or chew around the house. As I mentioned to you, this issue that we have with sore hocks, most pet rabbits seem to have a degree of sore hocks on clinical examination. What I find is when you're looking at the perineal area, if you just very carefully lift the fur over the point of the hock sideways, you very quickly can see that they're often very reddened areas. This can progress to a sort of linear dermatitis as well, and then in severe cases, such as the picture here, you can actually see scabbing and secondary problems with osteomyelitis. Now, interestingly, I've got a whole list of reasons why we might see this in pet rabbits. What's interesting is we did a study at Edinburgh Vet School, and we looked at predisposing causes in pet rabbits, in particular weight and substrate and husbandry, and unfortunately didn't find any significant factors that were involved. So statistically, nothing was a predisposition. Now, it is interesting that a lot of rabbits now are kept indoors on harder sort of laminate flooring. And this is something that, although our actual study didn't show it to be an issue, it's something I believe probably is a factor involved in the cases that we're seeing. And again, educating clients and discussing different or variable areas that the rabbit can sit on is really key to helping this condition, as well as a weight reduction program if the animal is overweight. So this is something, again, that you can be educating your client about. Some rabbits will chew if you've got things like foam matting. You have got to be very careful because rabbits can ingest that, but in some cases that can be beneficial, or we often discuss providing an area of coconut matting, which the rabbits tend not to chew, like these sort of, you know, doormats, basically, that the rabbit can sit on. And that can also help. In terms of perhaps daily care, application of a barrier such as Sudocream might be helpful in sort of milder cases. So when these lesions become progressive, you can actually get secondary bacterial infections, and we certainly have seen cases that have developed on to osteomyelitis, and these will actually need appropriate treatment, debriding, and also bandaging in some cases with repeated bandage changes. Always having a think about what could be the predisposition. The picture in this particular case, the animal was not voiding urine properly, and we had urine scalding and staining, and that was leading to a secondary pododermatitis. Worth just bearing in mind in Rex rabbits that this is something that we do see very commonly, and it can be very difficult to treat these cases. Usually in Rex rabbits, because of the lack of guard hairs on the hocks, you do actually need to dress these and apply bandages, and that is really the only way forward if you start to develop sore hocks in this particular breed. Hopefully also we're all aware of correct handling. I did put this slide in just because last week I saw two cases of vertebral fracture in pet rabbits through handling issues. And it is still a common problem in rabbits. Usually, hopefully not at the veterinary practice, but if owners are unaware of the potential for rabbits to kick back as they're being placed, this can very quickly, you know, lead to problems with vertebral fracture. And once it happens, it can be virtually impossible to do anything about. These cases are very similar in terms of management and treatment to dogs and cats. And prognosis obviously is very much dependent on your clinical assessment of the case. But it is something that can happen instantaneously. The case I had last week was literally just a rabbit that had been out in the garden and had suddenly been spooked by a noise and had jumped, and this had led to a vertebral fracture. When we are actually handling our animals in the practice, then we need to be very careful and clear that we have educated our staff really in terms of how to handle these animals, and to make sure the animal is secure as it's being lifted from the box, as it's being transported around the veterinary practice. And it's absolutely key that we do actually train our own personnel in terms of safe handling practices. So on to a favourite topic with rabbits, and again, hopefully you're all very much aware of what constitutes a good diet in a pet rabbit. I would say that this is probably the major cause of clinical disease problems that we see in rabbits, and it's not just the classic one that we think about, dental disease, but obesity is absolutely on the rise, I believe, in pet rabbits. We can get behavioural issues if we're not providing enough fibre in the diet. Fur pulling could potentially ensue. And then also gastrointestinal related problems. Saccharomycetes, yeast overgrowth, are very common if we're not feeding a high fibre diet. So absolutely key to the general health and well-being of our pet rabbits. Thinking about what a wild rabbit would eat, I mean, they literally just graze for a large part of the day. They're crepuscular, so sort of dawn and dusk, but they would also forage and take some small amounts of sort of shoots and roots as well. And thinking about how their digestive system has developed, it's really quite an interesting digestive system. And we always teach our students that these are rabbits are pretty much like mini horses, in more than dogs and cats, in terms of their digestive anatomy. So I thought I would just sort of give you a quick overview, because it's very easy to forget, you know, how different rabbits are compared to dogs and cats. They do have this very thin-walled, quite distensible stomach, and this is why you can get very, very distended stomachs with gastric bloat, with gas buildup, or with food impactions, and they can become absolutely huge. The stomach pH is normally acid, and then they have a very simple small intestine. Some pre-cecal digestion of fibre does take place by enzymes in the stomach and the small intestine, but most of the fibre is degraded or broken down by cecal microflora, and then some is expelled undigested as well. So looking at the hindgut, which is where pretty much most of the digestion of fibre occurs in rabbits, once it reaches this hindgut, it's either degraded by the cecal microflora or it's expelled undigested. The proximal colon is adapted so that it separates indigestible fibre from fibre that can be fermented in the cecum. And you get large undigestible fibre particles passing into the colon and then being expelled as the sort of dry hard droppings. But smaller particles can pass back into the cecum, and that's where they undergo bacterial fermentation. So feeding a high fibre diet of indigestible fibre is going to promote normal gut motility, but actually doesn't give any nutrient benefit to the animal. Whereas feeding high digestible fibre will provide nutrients but won't actually affect the gut motility. Hopefully most of our clients are not now feeding the commercial muesli type diets, because these are very low in fibre, high in carbohydrate, and selective feeding can occur. However, this still does happen, and I had a case referred to me just a month ago of a rabbit that was literally just being fed a muesli based diet with added sunflower seeds as well. So this is something, you know, that does occasionally still crop up and is worth going over with clients, you know, when you first see them, just to ensure that they are on the right sort of page in terms of the correct diet for their animal. Pelleted concentrate diets, in theory, should not need to be given to your pet rabbit. They are eaten very quickly, they're sort of high energy, but owners do like to feed them. The only time I would say that they are necessary, certainly, is in growing animals or animals during pregnancy or lactation. And again, we did a study at Edinburgh Vet School looking at growth rates and weight gain on different types of diets. And we did find that young animals really struggle to keep and maintain weight and also put on weight without the pelleted part of their diet. So I think if it's an older, mature rabbit, then reducing the pellets as much as possible really is beneficial. And we usually say, you know, in those sorts of cases where we're considering problems associated with diet with dental disease, then we would be thinking about 5 to 10 pellets perhaps per day for that individual. Obviously looking very carefully at their weight and checking that they don't lose weight on that diet. As a rule of thumb, they say sort of 20 grams per kilo per day maximum. But as I say, you can think about cutting this back even more in cases that are obese or that have dental disease and you're wanting to increase the indigestible fibre component. So any change in that whole setup of interaction between the microflora, the pH, the gut motility can lead to problems with the cecal motility, and that in turn can lead to diarrhea. And the picture at the top is showing a true diarrhea. We haven't got any normal droppings, whereas, the picture on the left is showing a true diarrhea. I'll point to it so that you can see it and I'm clear. Whereas the picture on the right is actually showing a cecal, is actually showing a matted cecotroph. So this is the true diarrhea here, and this is the matted cecotroph. And what we can also see is a small normal dropping just there, so we know that that is matted cecotrophs. Owners often get these two things confused, so it's important to discuss this with the owner and ask if there are any normal droppings still being produced. And if that's the case, then we need to be thinking about the likely causes for this diarrhea, and certainly stress and diet changes or an over-excess of diet can cause issues and lead to looseness of droppings. There are obviously infectious causes as well, but we're not going to discuss that within the topic of this talk today. Other environmental stresses that can affect gut motility in rabbits, certainly any changing in housing, any changes to sort of pair bondings, any recent introductions, if they've been transported or gone on a journey recently, extremes of weather and temperature. And certainly also, we do see a lot of animals going into gut stasis associated with a loss, you know, if a companion has died or if they've been separated for a period of time, this can occur. So other things that problems with diet can lead to, we mentioned obesity, but boredom is one factor. If animals are just fed a very quick eat diet and not provided with a diet that they can sit and chew for a period of time, this can lead to boredom issues. And it also can lead to a lack of dental wear. And then we get these sorts of spikes formations and ulcerations you can see in the picture here. And that can then progress quite quickly and rapidly to periodontal pocket formation and impaction of food and secondary infections with abscess formation. So diet is really, really, really key in these animals to get on top of and to educate clients about. Hopefully we are very much aware that really the most appropriate diet for rabbits is hay or grass. Now, often owners aren't feeding grass, particularly if these are indoor animals, and this has actually been shown grass to be even more beneficial for normal dental wear than hay. So this is something that perhaps we can start to talk to our clients about and encourage them to feed more grass. The picture there on that slide shows quite a large volume of commercial diet. Really, I would be saying a lot less than this. And as I mentioned earlier, owners really ought to be weighing these out and working out exact amounts for their pet animal. And in cases that are obese or have dental disease, reducing that component even more. Certainly, we can provide alternatives if owners are wanting to feed something else other than sort of hay and grass, then there are a number of wild plants that we can be feeding and also herbs. Owners often like to sort of grow these themselves and then provide these. If a rabbit's inappetent, then often these are the things that they really would like to eat. I would certainly only say once a week for any vegetables, and we definitely don't recommend feeding any fruits to rabbits. A carrot once a week is probably okay, but again, if you've got an animal with dental disease, I would probably just cut that out completely and just stick to leafy greens, hay, grass, and a very small amount of concentrates. This was a picture I took fairly recently in a pet shop, and you can see how many products there are available for pet rabbits. And all of these, I would really say, are pretty inappropriate. These are treat items that are often very sugary, and although owners like to feed these, they're not good for your pet rabbit. There is now a large amount of good quality treats that can be fed that are primarily hay and grass based. And these are sort of, you know, put into different formulations to look nice, really, I think, for owners, so that they can feed them as treat items, but they don't contain added sugar. So I would, if owners are wanting to feed extra, then maybe looking at these sorts of products would be a better alternative. But really, hay, more hay, and hay again is the overall message for rabbit diets. Good quality. A lot of times owners will want to get in a variable supply, so different types of hay can be liked in different ways by rabbits. So offering a wide range is a good idea as well, and offering fresh every day is absolutely key. Any changes should be gradual, and I think that's a take-home message for clients. Often they try and make changes very rapidly, or they feed in excess, and that's when we start to get dysbiosis and issues with gut motility. One thing just to note is certainly in America they do feed a lot of alfalfa to their pet rabbits, and this is high in calcium, and there's some thought that this can lead to problems with calculi and also hypercalciuria. Rabbits should normally be able to void the calcium that they ingest through the urinary system, and this is a normal mechanism, but in some cases it can lead to excessive crystal buildup and this incredible sort of sludge formation within the bladder, which can be very irritant. If you see in this picture, we have got a really thickened bladder wall, very erythematous, and this has significantly affected the bladder of this animal. It's important, I think, to realize that often there are other causes for this. So it's not just the diet per se that's predisposing. It might be that the animal has arthritis and is not actually voiding urine properly, and therefore the sludge builds up in the bladder. So worth looking at underlying predisposing causes for this, but in conjunction with dietary changes. So we are advising 6 monthly health checks because of the issues that can occur very commonly with pet rabbits in terms of their diet and husbandry. Also, pet rabbits are living to a greater age, and as they get older, things occur, particularly cardiac disease is quite common, arthritis, as I mentioned, is quite common, cataracts form. So therefore, we need to be looking at our older animals perhaps on a more regular basis. And letting clients know that rabbits don't show clinical signs of disease because they're prey species is absolutely key to this. You know, it's often that clients, even though they know their rabbits very well, don't always pick up on the very subtle clinical signs. One thing that I really wanted to talk to you about today is otitis externa in rabbits. And this is a condition that more and more we see, I would say, on a daily basis in our pet rabbits. It's something that is very easily missed and something that is, I hope, very easily prevented. But this is something that we will need to determine as we get more of our rabbits onto a sort of good preventative program for ear disease. So it is very, very, very common. What we usually see is an otitis externa, and this can manifest as a swelling at the very base of the ear. So in this rabbit, it's been clipped. You can just about see this area is quite distended. And that is where you're looking at for ear-based abscesses in pet rabbits. Now, we call them abscesses, but most of these are actually sterile. And pretty much we culture every single one, and it's very rare to get any bacterial component. What we think is that it's the lop-eared rabbits particularly that seem to be predisposed, and it's due to their ear anatomy and the fact that we have that large fold in the vertical ear canal, which occludes the ear canal and then predisposes to build up a wax and then secondary issues. So clinical examination is key for this, and often owners have not picked this up. So again, I go through this with my clients when I'm seeing them for health checks. I talk to them about where they should be feeling at the base of the ear, and get them to do it on a regular, perhaps a monthly basis with their pet animals. If this is discovered, then obviously we need to investigate it further rather than leaving it as it is. Usually we would do a CT examination to determine whether we've got material actually within the bulla and whether the tympanic membrane's intact. And certainly more and more of these cases, we are opting for surgical resolution. You can see the picture on the right here is a case that's had ear surgery. And they actually do very well. We have had some success with anaesthetizing rabbits and using endoscopy, flushing and removal of debris, but this can be quite a protracted experience and can take quite a considerable amount of time, and cases often do recur. So there are different options for how we manage these cases, but what we'd like to do is really avoid them getting to this situation in the first place. So again, talking to clients about how to actually look for this and about regular ear care, particularly in the lop-eared breeds. I mentioned about older animals and the issues that we see in the aged rabbit population. This is more and more relevant, I feel. We're seeing a lot of animals that are living older. 9, 10 is really not an uncommon age to see. And I had a case in just last week. It was a 14-year-old rabbit. So we need to start thinking about the issues that might occur with longevity. And particularly, a lot of these animals do have spondylosis of the spine, ventral spondylosis of the vertebrae, and osteoarthritis. And we've done a little pilot study at Edinburgh Vet School and found that a significant proportion of rabbits develop arthritis, particularly in the stifle joint. So that's the area really to look at if you're needing to radiograph the animal. We usually do whole body radiographs, but, you know, particular emphasis on the stifles to look for this condition. Renal disease, again, is also very common, and this can be really subtle in terms of the clinical signs. It might just be an animal that's losing a little bit of weight. You don't always see an increase in thirst, or an owner might not actually notice an increase in thirst. And again, taking a blood sample to diagnose this, and what I find even more useful is urine protein creatinine ratios, and that's actually something that will pick it up a little bit earlier than your blood results will do. Heart disease, very common in older rabbits to hear heart murmurs, and determining why there's a heart murmur is very key to managing that case. So they can be very difficult when a rabbit's got such a fast heart rate to hear. So spend some time, listen very carefully, and be aware that you know, heart murmurs often go undiagnosed, particularly if you've got a rabbit that's panting and the respiratory rate is actually almost the same as the heart rate. It can be very difficult. And as we get older, obviously neoplasia is a concern. And this is, again, something that we do see regularly in older animals. I mentioned cataracts as well, something to note to owners and for them to be aware of. If this does occur, then, you know, maybe not changing too much of the environment so that the animal is habituated to where everything is can be really beneficial. So what sort of healthcare program do we need for older animals? I think very important to be emphasizing the need to check these animals at least 6 monthly because of the subtlety of clinical signs, but also talking to owners about keeping an eye on things at home. So any sort of slight change in appetite or dislike of a particular food item, monitoring how much they're actually drinking on a regular basis, and looking at the urine and fecal output, as well as activity levels throughout the day, particularly important in animals that might have chronic pain through arthritis. And we really need to develop a good relationship with our rabbit clients so that we can get them to look out for very subtle changes with their animal. And I often will get them to do a sort of activity chart through the day. So once an hour, they will be recording what that animal is doing, particularly animals that I'm worried about being in pain. And we can actually see whether the animal is perhaps spending a lot of time sleeping and inactive. But that has got to be done over a 24-hour period, really, because obviously rabbits tend to be more active in the evening and early morning. Another thing that owners can very clearly monitor is body weight, and that also seems to be very beneficial because often aged animals will start to lose weight, and we can hopefully then pick up on that early on before we get further down the line and things progress to a very severe issue. I'm just briefly touching on behavioural problems. This is something, again, that we as vets often get asked about. Very, very common for owners to be concerned about aggression issues between different rabbits and different pairings of rabbits. And this is something that I get owners, you know, commonly phoning up to ask advice about. It is helpful to know that there are a lot of good information sources out there and good leaflets that the owners can access, particularly online. And so pointing them in those particular areas is a really good idea, because often these cases are far too complex really to discuss just in a single consultation. Now, we as vets obviously need to determine whether any of these behaviours are secondary to health issues. And certainly urine spraying may not be spraying. It may be that you've got a hypercalciuria issue and an irritated inflamed bladder. So we need to be aware of that. But also, if there are genuine behavioural problems that owners need help with, be able to point them in the right direction to get the appropriate advice that they need. To touch on flea treatment, hopefully we're all very much aware that rabbits can get their own fleas, and it's called the stickfast flea, and this is quite common in outdoor rabbits in the summer months. Really important, obviously, as I mentioned earlier, because they are vectors for myxomatosis. There are quite a few products out there, two in particular that are licensed and that can be used. And hopefully, if this is an issue, then we should be advising our clients to use these on a regular basis, as we would in dogs and cats. Fly strike is also another common condition in the summer months that can relatively easily be prevented. And again, educating owners about the underlying factors that can be causing this, you know, cage hygiene, obesity, problems with being able to re-eat the droppings, so dental disease or arthritis and spondylosis of the spine can all lead to matted cicatrophs and then secondary fly strike. So it can be pretty severe, and rabbits can be very ill with this and can die. So we need to be looking out for this on a regular basis. We need to be thinking about how we treat it. But I think perhaps more importantly, prevention. And there are products that are available. I've put this particular product, Cyromazine, which is a topical treatment that can be applied every 6 to 10 weeks. But there are other products such as F10, germicidal wound spray, and this is combined with an insecticide as well. So making sure that the owners are aware of this, preventing it, ensuring good hygiene, using fly screens, all will help to avoid this situation developing in pet rabbits. We often get asked by owners about worming their pet rabbits. This is a really, really common thing to be asked about because it's so routine in dogs and cats. What I always say to owners is that it's very rare to have pathogenic endoparasites. And although you may see rabbit pinworms being passed, it doesn't tend to cause overt clinical disease. This was a sample that was taken post-mortem from the cecum of a rabbit showing the worms. And you can actually see also in these droppings, sometimes you can see little worms there as well. If you saw that, I probably would treat the animal just in case it were to become an overwhelming burden. But it's not supposed to cause clinical disease. And as I say, I think it's more because owners see them in the droppings and don't like them that we end up treating these cases. But probably best, certainly practice, is to perform fecal analysis. If an owner wants the animal wormed, it's much better to take a sample and check. And if they're free of any endoparasites, you don't need to go ahead and treat. The reason being that treatment often is with fenbendazole, and this can have side effects, particularly in terms of immunosuppression. Another area that I commonly get asked about is whether we should prophylactically treat animals for E. coli. And there are some vets who are recommending a short sort of treatment course or deworming course, particular panicure for pet rabbits. Now, I think a very short course is only going to really protect at the time that is being given. So over the sort of short 9-day period, it's not actually going to treat a clinical infection. And reinfection is also possible. So what we actually recommend at the vet school is that new rabbits do receive a full 28-day course of fenbendazole. And obviously any in-contact rabbits at the same time. So this is where it is actually useful if rabbits have previously been exposed to the parasite at the sort of source or perhaps in a rescue centre by contact with other animals. And then they're coming to a home where they're going to be on their own or with just one other animal. And then hopefully by treating, we can treat any infection that might have been acquired, but also prevent any infection from occurring within that 28-day period. So that makes sense to me, and that's what we do, certainly with new animals that are coming in. We recommend this 28-day treatment protocol. I wanted also, just finally wrapping up really at the end, to talk about insurance. One thing that really interested me recently, we had a look at our cases that come into the vet school, and of all the exotic cases, and not just rabbits, we found that overall only 3% of our cases were insured, which is a shockingly small number. But what was then interesting, we looked at the rabbit cases that are referred to us, and 48% of those were insured. So it's still not as prevalent as we would like to think as vets, the insurance of pet rabbits. And it is something that really we must be discussing with our clients as it can save such a lot of heartache later when you're having to make financial decisions on your pet's health. So something not to sort of forget at the end of your health check, just to have a brief chat with your client and explain the sort of benefits of having your animal insured. So that really wraps up the presentation today. I have had a couple of questions I just wanted quickly to talk through with you. One question in particular was talking about ear disease in pet rabbits and any recommended routine ear treatments. This is actually an area where we're trying to look at, really, in lop-ear breeds in particular, whether use of routine ear cleaners is beneficial. And certainly if I'm looking down a rabbit's ear and I'm seeing signs of inflammation or excessive wax buildup, then I am recommending the routine use of a dog or cat ear cleaner for these animals. If there's actual inflammation, then you might want to look at medicated products, but usually a lot of these cases just have a degree of wax starting to build up. So I think hopefully, I mean, this is sort of early days, but if we can get in with preventative routine ear treatments for lop-eared rabbits, then maybe we can avoid these accumulations developing and any further, you know, surgery down the line. So that's really thinking about routine ear treatments. The other question I had was actually about weight reduction programs in pet rabbits, and what would I recommend in terms of an obese rabbit and trying to reduce weight. We generally say to clients no more than 10% weight loss per month, but I actually go lower than that and say no more than 5% of body weight loss per month. Do it very gradually, weigh the rabbits on a regular basis at home and get them back in perhaps on a monthly basis to check that weight in the practice. Ways we can achieve this, obviously initially reducing the amount of pellets gradually can be a key way, but also cutting out these extra things like carrots, apples, any treat type items as well. So I don't see any further questions being asked. So thank you very much for listening in today and for your time. And I hope that you've enjoyed this webinar.
On behalf of Webinar Club, I'd like to thank Emma for a great presentation today. The recording and the certificate for this webinar will be available in the next few days in the members area of Webinar Club. Thank you all for attending. That's the end of the webinar.